I guess while we wait for a quorum and enough people to be present, we can start with a testimony. And I believe Deb Sundin is first on the list. Ms. Sundin, welcome to the committee. Look forward to hearing from your testimony.
Like me to start?
Well, yeah, please state your name for the record.
Okay. My name is Deborah Sundin, and I am the Director of Energy Efficiency Marketing from Xcel Energy. And I was rolled over from last week, and hopefully you all have copies of my presentation. It was handed out at that meeting. I'm here today just to do a quick update on what Xcel Energy is preparing to meet the new legislative goals in 2010. But I want to spend most of my time talking about the financial disincentives to energy efficiency, which I think rolls kind of right into your other topics this morning or this afternoon. If we'd like to start on page 2, if you do have my presentation in front of you, I don't think I need to go through most of this, because when I was here last week, a lot of the presenters talked about the same thing. We do have a statewide goal to get to 1.5% of retail energy sales with both our gas and electric savings by 2010. There's a couple of ways to do that. The utility, the established utility program, have to come up with at least a minimum of 1% of sales, and then there's some other things the state can do or the utilities can do to count other savings. I just wanted to set the stage on page... On page 3 of my presentation, I've been upstage. What can I do?
I think Representative Thielen likes to make an entrance when he
paid no attention to that man behind me.
We are on page 3, if you do have the presentation. We are currently going through a resource plan in front of the Public Utilities Commission, and in that resource plan we have proposed getting to 1.3% sales by 2012 and ramping up before then 1.15 in 10, 1.2 in 2011, and then to the 1.3 level in 2012. We don't have a decision on that yet, and we are waiting for that from the PUC. If you take a look at slide 4, in 2009, our approved goal for gigawatt hour savings is 264 gigawatt hours. In 2010, our estimate based on what we know about sales today in the equation is that we will be going up to 358 gigawatt hours, and that's based on the 1.15. If we were to try and hit the whole 1.5%, we would have to go to 470 gigawatt hours, which is almost doubling what we've been doing historically and are projected to do this year. On page 5, we have been, since January of 2008, we have been doing some organized planning on how we're going to ramp up to meet these goals. I've had over 30 growth teams meetings to take a look at everything we do and the gaps we have in our current portfolio of programs. And we are coming up with a lot of recommendations, all of which will probably come together in the June 1st triennial filing, which we actually have to lay out our plan on how we're going to meet 2010 through 2012 goals. What I really wanted to spend, and I was only supposed to have about 5 minutes, and I want to try and keep it to that, but I really wanted to take most of my time to talk about today is what Xcel Energy sees as the financial impacts of aggressive energy efficiency on our company and how we're working with the legislation as well as the regulators to try and make this a positive incentive for us, so that we can align what we're doing in our business and our business financials with what we see the state wants us to do as part of their energy policy. When we look at financial disincentives, we see it as two different major things in our normal operations. The first of all is lost revenues or lost margins. I'm sure a lot of you know that we have both variable costs and fixed costs to our operations, and the fixed costs are the contributions to our or the margins are the contributions to our fixed costs, and they are built into the service charge, but they are also built into our volumetric energy charge. So if you reduce sales because of energy efficiency, in between rate cases, we actually lose the contribution to margins that that represents. And that is and can be a significant issue for us in a very aggressive scenario for energy efficiency. The other piece that we see when you're trying to change the model from a growth model to an energy efficient model is our lost opportunity earnings of capital investment in plants. That's how the traditional, when we're making traditional rate making and investment, we put steel in the ground, that's what we earn on. And if we turn to a model that has aggressive energy efficiency, we are losing the opportunity to actually grow the investment we put in plants and transmission and distribution, and therefore there's a lost opportunity to growth there. Those are the two main sources and issues besides cost recovery, and the state of Minnesota has given us a really good cost recovery mechanism, so it doesn't seem to be an issue right now. But those are the three things we really look at when we're looking at changing over from a supply all the electricity anybody wants in a growth scenario to an energy efficiency push from the utilities. We are working, obviously we're in conversations here at the legislation on how to make the disincentives of energy efficiency go away. We're also working with the PUC in the existing legislation that's out there for SIP. It does allow the commission to provide us with an incentive. The incentive was not based in the past on having us recover all of our financial disincentives, but it was a good mechanism to have us recover part of them. We are currently working within the PUC docket that's open right now to try and look at mechanisms that will combat the disincentives, and that they'll combat not only all of our disincentives financially, but give us a little bit of an earnings plug as well, so that what we really want to see is that energy efficiency, to do energy efficiency is going to earn us more money than actually investing in supply. And I think if that were to happen, you would see the utilities full front supporting this, pushing this, and a lot of our issues would go away.
With respect to that, when you say utilities, do you mean IOUs or do you mean all utilities as a whole?
Right now I'm talking about IOUs. The municipals and co-ops have a different financial mechanism or environment that they work around. And it's the IOUs that have the shareholders in the shareholder concerns and raise the capital a little bit different way. So I would say the IOUs. The other thing I just wanted to introduce, there's a lot of discussion and there's going to be a lot of discussion today around decoupling. And decoupling is a mechanism that can be looked at. Xcel Energy is not opposed to decoupling. We haven't quite figured out the appropriate mechanism that we think will actually get around the issues we see in front of us that would be approved by the PUC, but decoupling is something that can be considered. We don't believe it's the only thing that can be considered. We think that we can get at this disincentive issue by other mechanisms, whether it's a very robust performance incentive, a basic incentive plus a performance incentive. You know, you can do a loss margin recovery, though most people have kind of moved away from that. It was something that was done historically. But there seems to be an impression that we're totally against decoupling, and we're not. We just really are worried about what the actual final mechanism would look like.
Representative Phelan, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Sundin, the one tool I think that we haven't explored here in Minnesota, and I didn't hear you mention it yet either, is treating efficiency and capital and, or gave away the punchline, and conservation as a regulatory asset or a capital asset. I know that I don't want Xcel Energy or any utility to own the windows that I might put in my house, and you, I don't think you want to either. But at the same time, there's a huge amount of capital opportunity. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about the potential for treating not title to the assets, but classifying them as regulatory assets, and then getting a competitive or even advantageous return on investment for doing that efficiency from the PUC.
You know, that is one mechanism that is possible and can be looked at. We actually have had that mechanism in the past in Colorado. We've moved away from it now. It is one thing that people talk about. The issue, the couple of issues and why we tried to move away from it in Colorado were predominantly that we weren't sure the longevity of the political support for energy efficiency. Might be more so now than it was back a few years ago. But if you take a look at those kinds of amortization over, you know, whether it's 10 years or 15 years or 8 years, you're building your asset base for quite a few years. And then if you are kind of flattening out what you're spending in the market, it goes across and kind of flattens out as well. But then if somebody comes in and says, okay, we don't like energy efficiency anymore, stop it, and we stop spending, then we have like 10 years where we're still collecting on what we refer as a stranded asset. And based on whether or not a public utilities commission is agreeable to let us collect on that stranded asset for that many years, it's always been our question. So it's, there's some risk to it, but it can be done. It can be financially a good way to do it, too.
Representative Phelan.
Mr. Chair and Chair Hilty, I think that when the largest bond houses are now telling us that the bond that they could sell even in December, when they couldn't sell any other bond, the most marketable bond is an energy efficiency bond. And I met with the bank that on, I guess it's Friday morning in D.C., that is interested in building a $1.5 to $2 billion fund for efficiency and renewables. And I think that more and more we're seeing that, you know, once this economy comes back, oil is going to be at 100, 120, 140 with gas appropriately so. And I think that efficiency is going to become the wisest and most marketable investment. I think that for the next decade or two, or maybe for as long as we all live. So I hope that we can look at this and actually make a commitment bipartisanly to making the cleanest, cheapest energy source also the most attractive within the financial ladder.
Any other questions, members? Well, thank you. Sure. Representative Westrom.
Just wondering if Representative Kalin has given me some insight that I should go by long on some of these energy futures. And my history is usually if I do that, they'll go down. So can you give me that guarantee? Oh, 120.
We'll leave that to the financial whizzes. Seeing that we do have a quorum present, I would ask approval of the minutes.
So moved.
Representative Westrom moves approval of the minutes. All in favor say aye.
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 Minutes are approved. Next on the agenda, we have reports on decoupling and decoupling pilot programs from Mr. Haar from the Public Utilities Commission. Mr. Haar, welcome to the committee again.
Sure. Nice
to see
you. Thank you very much. I do have a handout. I have a PowerPoint, too, but I don't see a computer here, so I guess I'll do it the old-fashioned way.
Was it just light reading?
Pardon me? Well, that, yeah. You could rely on that as well, but what I am handing out here is a far condensed version of that. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission. I'm here to talk a little bit today about a task that we were given by the 2007 legislature, which was to develop some standards for decoupling and to report to you on our progress. I have handed out some slides, and while that's being done, I'll just mention that the wad of paper that the chairman handed up is the report that we sent in. It goes into considerable detail on the subject of decoupling. The vast majority of that particular document is a report that we had prepared for us by a consulting agency by the name of the Regulatory Systems Project. And maybe with that, I'll go into the slides and use that as a framework for my presentation. First of all, what is decoupling? It's a method of regulation intended to minimize or remove financial disincentives affecting utility investment in energy efficiency behind the customer's meter. Minnesota Statute 216B.2412 provides a very good definition, I think, a very specific definition as to what decoupling is and what it's intended to do. The statutory requirement that is provided in law came via the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007. It required the commission to do a couple of things. First of all, establish criteria and standards for a decoupling program, and then also to allow a pilot program in order to assess the merits of decoupling and achieving energy savings. And of course, the decoupling initiative was combined with the energy savings goals that were also addressed in that legislation, and that were intended to complement the achievement, I guess you could say, of those goals. As noted on slide number three there, the standards and criteria the commission are intended to or should mitigate the impact on utilities of achieving the state-mandated energy savings goals, and also it needs to be done in such a way so that ratepayers are not adversely affected. So we have to kind of keep both parties whole in the process of removing this disincentive that exists. And then as far as the pilot project is concerned, the commission is to allow one or more pilot projects to assess the merits, as pointed out there. Pilot program must utilize the criteria and standards that the commission will be setting. It must be designed to determine whether the proposed rate decoupling strategy actually achieves energy savings. It may not exceed 3 years. It may be approved in a general rate proceeding, or it also may be approved elsewhere, but any extension of a pilot program must be approved as part of a rate proceeding, and as already noted, the commission must also issue a report. As far as the commission's actions in response to the laws passed in 2007, the commission, as I just mentioned a minute ago, contracted with the Regulatory Assistance Project to prepare a report. There's a lot of information on decoupling out and about. There are many sources about the advantages and disadvantages, the risks, and so on of decoupling. But we needed assistance to develop a plan that fits Minnesota's requirements and history, particularly the substantial history of energy conservation programs through the Conservation Improvement Program, and, of course, the energy savings goals that are already mandated by statute. So we need something that fit our specific circumstances. And that's what we asked the RAP, the RAP, to help us with. They held a number of stakeholder meetings with not only with the commissioners and commission staff and Department of Commerce staff and utilities, with wide cross-section of parties were involved, and then issued the report in June, I believe it was, end of June of 08. And as I said, that's the lion's share of the report that was held up earlier. The report, by the way, can be found on our website under the directions I provided there on the slide. The report does include recommendations on standards and criteria. It also includes a straw proposal intended to address the particular circumstances in Minnesota. But the commission has not acted on that report yet. As indicated by the slide there, the commission solicited comments on the RAP report. Those comments are in now, and we plan to bring that docket back to the commission sometime in the second quarter, April, May timeframe somewhere. The commission has also taken some related action. Also, as part of the Next Generation Energy Act of 07, the commission was to set procedures for evaluation of whether and what changes to current performance incentives were needed. There are currently financial incentives for demand-side management and so on that have actually been in place for a few years, and the intention was to make sure that the incentives were adjusted and lined up properly with whatever is going to be done on decoupling. So the commission has issued an order on that, and stakeholders are in the process of evaluating alternative incentive models. They're looking at how decoupling might fit each utility's incentive model. And the order and the documents for that are, as for all of these, both of these proceedings are accessible by our website if you're interested. Just turning for a few minutes then to the standards and criteria issues, just to give you a sense of sort of what's in play there, I guess you could say. There are two kind of overarching issues that have come up. First is how specific should the commission be in detailing standards and criteria? Is it a one-size-fits-all kind of approach, or do we do it on a case-by-case basis? Most of the parties seem to agree that the cookie-cutter approach is not the best approach, that there needs to be some tailoring to specific circumstances, but as I say, that is yet to be resolved. A secondary issue is pointed out also on the slide, and that is, should the standards and criteria be individually tailored to capture differences between the electric industry and the gas industry? That is another sort of threshold issue that's involved in the discussion that's been taking place. In addition, there are a whole host of other matters. As we all know, the devil's in the details, and there are plenty of details to work through on decoupling program. I've given you just a few that are currently that have been brought up in the comments and have been involved in the discussions we've had. First of all, should a showing of energy savings related to conservation investment be required as part of a pilot program? Should their utilities be required to actually demonstrate that there was a savings and that their earnings were affected by those savings? Secondly, should a decoupling pilot plan be required for electric and for gas utilities? Difference of opinion on that, as you might expect, but it is something that is under discussion and has been involved and included in the comments that we receive. Third, to what extent does decoupling affect the utility's business and financial risk? Decoupling involves automatic rate adjustments that correct for the possibility of under-recovery due to declining sales, of course. That's the fundamental process. should whatever, I guess the question is, should whatever effects on risk attributable to decoupling be reflected in the utility's authorized cost of capital? Should it, in other words, should there be some adjustment if, in fact, it does reduce the business or financial risk for the utility? Some would say yes. Others say it's not been shown that there is any reduction in risk attributable to decoupling. So, again, we have differences of opinion on how that all plays out, and it's something the Commission is going to be working through as it looks at the standards and criteria. Probably one of the major questions here is how to avoid adversely affecting ratepayers. Decoupling is intended to hold the utility harmless for reduced sales due to energy efficiency programs, but as we know, sales can decline due to other factors as well, weather, economic conditions, to name a couple of major ones. Well, we need to account for those additional factors as well in setting these standards in order that the program is accurately tracking the factors that are at work here. Again, difference of opinion on how this should be done. Proponents of decoupling are stating that any increase in rates due to decoupling would be offset by a reduction in costs due to greater efficiency, even though the per unit amount might be higher under decoupling. Hopefully, consumers are going to be using less, so their overall bill would be less. Others state that no ratepayer should be adversely affected as a result of decoupling. So, again, some issues to work through there. One of the proposals is whether or not to include a cap, a rate cap, under the program. With decoupling, a revenue requirement is established, and automatic rate adjustments are allowed that generate that revenue requirement. For the rate cap, those automatic adjustments would be allowed only up to a specified level. For example, a 3% cap, any need to adjust rates beyond that would not be allowed automatically. It would have to go into some other alternative process or be deferred for some other rate proceeding, perhaps a rate proceeding. Also, as the slide points out, there have been suggestions about bringing in service quality standards, making that a requirement of any pilot program. There are issues relating to whether or not certain customer classes should be included or excluded. Should it apply to all customer classes, or should some classes be excluded from the decoupling program, and if so, what's the rationale for doing so? So those are all issues that are in play and have come up through this discussion process, and that the Commission will have to be working through as it proceeds. We do have one pilot program proposal in front of us. It's also an active docket, just like the other investigation is. That is the proposal set forth by CenterPoint Energy as part of their rate case. I mentioned to you when I was here before, we had four major rate cases. CenterPoint is one of them, and they have a pilot program for decoupling included in their proposal. They call it the Conservation Enabling Rider. This would apply to residential, commercial, and very small volume firm industrial customer classes. As indicated, the rates for these classes would be automatically adjusted so that the actual revenues equal the amount of the test year revenues allowed in the rate case, but adjusted for customer growth. So it's sort of a classic decoupling proposal in that respect. The case, however, the rate case of which the proposed decoupling program is a part, is in its very early stages yet. We still have to go through public hearings and evidentiary hearings and that whole process, this case will not be back before the Commission until December of this year. The order is due by January 11th of next year. So hopefully that gives you a good sense of what the Commission has done, some of the issues the Commission faces in looking at decoupling, and a little bit about the proposal that CenterPoint has put forward. I'm sure they'd be very happy to come up and talk more about it if you would like to hear from them as well. I just stand for questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Haar. Any questions from members? Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Harrell, that RAP you mentioned, Regulatory Assistance Project, who are they? Where they come from? How did we find them?
Well, they are a nationally known consulting firm. They have provide services in a variety of areas dealing with rate proceedings, rate design, conservation, energy efficiency. They are based, well, they're based in several places. I know, I think they're originally based in Maine. We went through an RFP process, and because of their experience, particularly on decoupling, because they worked with a number of states doing the same thing they did with us, basically, to help them evaluate the program and so on, they were selected for the project.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Harr, could you give us some specifics on what the difference would be in, you know, the criteria that are currently used in a rate case compared to what criteria would have to be developed for the decoupling scenario?
Dr. Harr.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess I'm not entirely sure what criteria you're referring to. I mean, the criteria for a decoupling plan, I mean, in the broadest sense, that as the consultants put it, decoupling is basically setting a budget for the utilities and making them stick to it. And it's true that once the revenue requirement is established, rates are automatically adjusted to maintain that level, but that level of revenue requirement has to be very closely evaluated to ensure that it's accurate and reflects the actual needs of the company, so on. And another critical part of it, in order to make it accomplish what it is intended to from a public policy standpoint, is what kind of accountability measures are built into the decoupling plan to ensure that whatever the policy, you know, goals are, energy efficiency, what have you, are actually accounted for, are measured, and are part of that process. So those are in very broad terms, sort of some of the criteria and issues that the Commission will have to be dealing with. I don't know if that's responsive to your question or not, sir.
Close, yes.
Okay.
I'll offer one question. I think kind of the nature of what some of this policy is intended to do is to really look at how do we curb energy growth or use. In your opinion, I mean, there's really three things that energy use can do. It can either grow, plateau, or decline. Do you think that this is an effective policy at either causing energy use to plateau or decline?
Mr. Chair, no disrespect, but having an opinion is above my pay grade on something like this, so I guess I'm going to hold off on that, since the Commission has an active docket on this and has a lot of details to work through. Certainly, the intent here of decoupling, you know, it's an important one, I think. It does look at you know, what can be done to ensure that we move forward with all the cost-effective energy efficiency measures that we can, and we don't want to have obstacles in the way. And if the current regulatory process is somehow inhibiting that, then we need to look at that. But we also have to remember that Minnesota has a long history of energy conservation. In fact, we're held up as a model to the entire country on energy conservation. And we now have energy savings mandated goals. So we have things in place here that several other states who have looked at decoupling, in fact, have adopted decoupling, did not start with. So our situation is a little different, and that's partly what makes it an interesting topic.
Thank you. Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Go ahead and ask me if I have opinions on this.
No, Dr. Harrell, and I know, I think CenterPoint's going to get up and speak to it here in a moment.
Good.
This whole thing comes out, of course, of our hubris and thinking that we can, and you don't have to respond to this part, I have a question coming up, thinking that we can wave our legislative wand and tell people how much power they're not going to buy, and then get into the whole business of how do we measure something that doesn't happen. But beyond that, it appears that decoupling has become an issue that people who are regulated and expect a certain rate of return have bumped up against in trying to accomplish our legislative opinion, wish, what have you. Do I understand that we're going to try, and I think I heard you say this, that we're going to try a pilot project first with one of our regulated utilities, so before we send the whole thing over the cliff, we're going to try one and see how it goes and kind of cut our teeth on that one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard. Yeah, actually the statute requires the commission to allow or approve a pilot, at least one pilot a project to evaluate the merits, to assess the merits of the decoupling, just to see if does it do what we intended for it to do, you know, and how well are we doing on that. One of the issues that's come up in the discussion, and I don't know if I mentioned it or not, is you know, should we have at least one natural gas and at least one electric utility decoupling plan, or do we just leave it up to the utilities to decide if they want to volunteer for the pilot program like CenterPoint has or not? So that's another sort of related question that's come up. But yes, that's the intent.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, my optimism sprang up for a moment when you said we required one, at least one. Then I heard at least one. Now you're saying we may want to do one in each field. Anybody volunteering or rushing to your place to ask you about it yet?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, CenterPoint is the only one that has actually made a filing on that. And as I said, the commission hasn't decided on whether to require or not. That's just an issue that's come up in the comments. It's one of the things that's, you know, involved in the review here.
Okay. Representative Phelan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might help shed some light on the questions that Representative Beard was asking as the author of the decoupling sections of the Next Generation Act of 07. The gas utilities had asked for the pilot project capability, and we had worked for a few months to try to work out an opportunity for it to work for electrical utilities, and decided that in God we trust, everyone else bring data, that we would try it first on those who were asking to have this available to them, and we would actually look at the data on the ground and look at its impact on conservation, on ratepayers, and the other factors that you mentioned, Mr. Hart. So I think that you did mention, to transition into a question myself, modeling after Representative Beard's same format here. You did mention the possibility or potential of requiring all cost-effective conservation be completed.
Sure.
And I'm wondering if, considering that we have this out there that it's 1 cent, 2 cent, maybe 3 cent a kilowatt hour just on the electrical side, I can't remember what the data is for BTU, compared to 6 or 7 or 8 cents a kilowatt hour for new generation from the utility's own calculations. What if we were to actually require all cost-effective efficiency and conservation before seeking a certificate of need, what would that impact have in relation to or compared to decoupling?
Mr. Chair, wow, you're
Dr. Harr.
I don't know if I have the background numbers to do that. I that's something I think I'd want to consult with my colleagues about and to get back to you, and I can certainly, you know, respond to the entire committee on it, but I don't know that I can give you a number on that, or give you sort of magnitude of the impact on that, just offhand, or if I even should offhand, to be honest with you.
Just a quick follow-up.
Representative Phelan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hart, does the commission currently do an analysis or calculation when looking at certificates of need about the total conservation and efficiency potential within a service territory, or is it merely in judging against either the IRP in front of you, or the rate case or the certificate of need application? I mean, is it more reactive? Is there anybody doing comprehensive efficiency potential calculations outside the utility currently?
Dr. Mr. Hart. Chair, a representative, I think, you know, the answer to your initial question is, yeah, I mean, the commission certainly looks at energy conservation, the potential for that in any certificate of need filing. It is required by law to do that. It does that. It evaluates, you know, the alternatives, including energy efficiency. When you say an exhaustive energy efficiency study, that could mean a number of different things. And my experience with those is that they can be fairly controversial based on the assumptions you build into them. So that can be tricky business. But certainly the commission does that. It's required to do that, and it does look at alternatives, and it, you know, it relies to a significant degree on what the parties bring to them for purposes of making that evaluation. And I would have to say that in those instances, our records are usually very complete. I think they're very thorough.
Just one last question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Phelan.
I think this is very helpful, Mr. Hart, I think, in terms of looking at how we actually structure the incentives and investment and the foundational piece of it. Are there ever third-party interveners looking at the conservation and efficiency numbers? I mean, having been an intervener or participated in an intervener case on a transmission side, let's say during an IRP or a rate case or even on a certificate of need, specifically a third party with its expertise in efficiency and conservation.
Mr. Chair,
Dr.
Representative, I'm trying to think of specific examples where that, you know, where I can name names. Unfortunately, I can't, but certainly third party, our certificate of need proceedings attract a wide variety of very interested parties. They are able to and do bring in expertise to make their points. Many of them quite often are, you know, very concerned and looking at energy efficiency. So, yes, that sort of third-party, independent, if you will, perspective is certainly allowed in the proceeding and usually is present. Again, I could probably go back and do some research to give you more details if you want, but I guess the answer is yes.
Mr. Elissa, do you have a comment?
Just in response to Representative Kalin's question, reading from the Certificate of Need provision, 216B.243 in Subdivision 3, no proposed large energy facility shall be certified for construction unless the applicant can show that the demand for electricity cannot be met more cost-effectively through energy conservation and load management measures. And in assessing need, the commission is supposed to evaluate a number of factors, one of which is whether any feasible combination of energy conservation improvements required under Section 216B.241 that can, one, replace part or all the energy to be provided by the proposed facility, and two, compete with it economically. So there is provision in current statute for certificate of need projects to look at conservation first.
Follow up on that. Dr. Hart, with respect to the most recent certificate of need proceeding, I believe, which was about six stone lines, do you think that there was enough looked at with respect to meeting those with conservation and efficiency renewables, or that those alternatives were not able to meet the need? Or,
Mr. Chair, again, you're asking for my opinion, and I'm as the spokesperson for the commission, my opinion really doesn't hold much weight, but this can say the Big Zone record was by far the largest record, the most extensive, the most exhaustive record I think the commission has had in quite some time. The only other cases that come close, I think, are the externalities proceeding that we had back in the early 90s and, of course, Prairie Island. This was an extraordinary case in terms of the extent to which the commission went to develop the record and the amount of information that was included in it.
Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hart, going back to the question of standards and criteria, Could you tell us what the rationale would be for excluding certain customer classes? What are the arguments surrounding that issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, I'm sort of waiting to hear the rationales myself. This has been, been proposed as an issue. I think perhaps CenterPoint, could answer that based on some of their own individual experience. But there may be concerns about the rate impact on certain customers who are subject to extreme competitive conditions. That may be an adverse effect and place them at a disadvantage. I'm thinking, a large power loser user. That's one rationale. I don't necessarily say it's the proper rationale for an exemption because no decisions have been made on that. But that is an argument that I've heard before.
Any further questions from members? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Fawcett, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Eric Swanson. I work with Winslow and Weinstein, and we represent CenterPoint Energy. And appreciate the opportunity to be here to talk to you briefly about decoupling. Dr. Hart's done a great job of providing a lot of the background, so I'll try to keep my comments fairly brief. As you know, CenterPoint is the state's largest natural gas provider. We serve about 700,000 customers in the state, an issue of great importance to us. By quick way of background again, in 2007, this committee helped craft the Next Generation Energy Act that's been discussed already. It really did mark the start of, we think, a new era in energy policy for the state of Minnesota. In particular, the act established aggressive new goals for conservation. And as Dr. Haar alluded, coupled with that was the act bringing Minnesota in line with a number of other states in establishing decoupling policy for the state of Minnesota and calling for the commission to approve one or more pilot projects for decoupling programs to assess the ability of decoupling to promote conservation by the utilities. In doing that, the statute, of course, recognizes that a utility's financial interest is in increasing sales, not decreasing sales. And the idea is that through decoupling, we can better align the interests of the utility, the ratepayers, and the state in achieving these aggressive goals that were set forth. Dr. Haar has done a great job at describing the commission's work. I won't repeat that. CenterPoint has participated throughout in the commission's stakeholder process, commented on the consultant's report that Dr. Haar discussed. CenterPoint's also been working with other gas utilities to perform market potential studies to explore the issue a little deeper, looking at how our customers are using natural gas in Minnesota, how the market has been impacted by historical energy savings, what new technologies are available, new applications that may help us conserve greater in the future, and trying to assess the cost of these incremental energy savings that we're trying to achieve. That work is still ongoing, but we believe it'll be very useful as the record gets further developed and as we explore more options for achieving the savings goals that were set out in the statute. Dr. Haar also discussed the fact that CenterPoint is the one utility that has raised its hand so far and volunteered. And said we'd like to have a pilot program. That is an issue in our current rate case. That will be a contested proceeding before the commission with a number of parties. We believe that we'll be active in it. So I want to keep my remarks rather general on that, but we think that that case will be a great opportunity to really flesh out the issues maybe beyond what's being done in the general stakeholder process and focusing exclusively then on
on center point and what makes sense for us. As far as the key points of issue going forward, we do think it's important to recognize that, that one size is not going to fit all here. Different programs may make sense for different utilities. What may make sense for a natural gas utility may not make sense for an electric utility. Those are all things that will have to be thoroughly explored and that the Commission is already wrestling with. The extent of the decoupling program is going to be an issue of significant debate, no doubt. From CenterPoint's perspective, full decoupling, we believe, provides the greatest potential. We don't want to see such timid steps taken that we can't achieve the goals that we were trying to reach with the decoupling statute and really unleash the potential and best align the interests of all the stakeholders in the process. But that, too, will be an issue of some debate, I'm certain, going forward. And all of these are things that we're going to be working through over the next several months, both in the general stakeholder process that Dr. Hart referred to that will come before the Commission later this spring, and particularly in the company's rate case. And we very much look forward to that ongoing discussion. We think it can lead to a decoupling program for the company that will help us meet the goals you established and provide some useful information going forward as we look at expanding decoupling potentially to other utilities. And with that, I'll end my remarks mercifully, quickly, and stand for questions.
Any questions from members? Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe not necessarily for CenterPoint, but I'm curious why none of the electrical companies wanted to be part of the pilot project. And I'm just looking through the report here we've got from the PUC, and I see that there were nine different states or so cited here as, I'm even counting California, which I hate to follow anything they do on energy stuff, since the lights don't work sometimes out there. But I noticed most of those, the vast majority of them at least, are gas companies and they're not electric companies. And I guess that my first question is why aren't we seeing the electric companies step up? And then number two, I have a question. I noticed on at least one of them that is an electric company, they have a cost of energy provision where the company's power costs are subject to a quarterly fuel adjustment clause, and I was wondering if PUC was going to do that or how often they would do a cost of fuel adjustment to whatever is decided. Might be more of a question for Mr. Harlan.
Yep, Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't work with electric utilities on these issues, so I think I'll leave that one to Dr. Har.
Dr. Har, welcome back.
Thank you. Regarding the fuel clause adjustment, the Commission, like most other state regulatory bodies, has in place a fuel clause adjustment process whereby the electric utilities will track their cost of fuel and those costs will be automatically passed through with a true-up process. So the same is true for gas utilities for the cost of gas. So that is an ongoing process. We're not as current in it as we would like to be, but it is an ongoing process.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up with that, and I don't trade in the in those sort of markets. I certainly do as a farmer in some of the other commodities. But could you give me an example, Mr. Howell, about how that would work with the company? Would they, if they had a cost of fuel adjustment clause in there? And would they typically contract this fuel with an entity or on the Board of Trade, for example, natural gas, if they were using that to supply of the energy. It seems like the coal plants are disappearing.
I think Mr. Swanson may be in a better position to respond on behalf of the company.
Mr. Swanson?
Tag team match
yeah.
here. Mr. Chair, Representative Magnus, on the gas side, yeah, the company has a fairly broad portfolio that it puts together to provide its natural gas services to customers. We make both monthly and annual reports to the commission. Those are reviewed, and then essentially for the gas utilities, the cost of gas is a simple pass-through. As long as the company has gotten its supplies prudently, we recover the cost of gas that was provided to Minnesota customers, no more, no less, but only after review and approval by the PUC.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, perhaps Representative Magnus's question might be answered by a little bit more of why we heard, when we were putting the bill together in 2007, the natural gas center point specifically with Eager and the electric company were far less so. The center point, briefly, center point is on a declining sales, declining revenue picture, and so therefore their opportunity to grow revenue is obviously in severe decline as well, and so wanting more stable income to cover fixed infrastructure costs. In the electrical utilities market, even with our aggressive 1.5% savings goal, they're still on a growth rate of about 0.5% a year, so their revenue is continuing to increase. Therefore, they don't have the same pressure to look at these. But I think that ultimately we'll see them want, I mean, we heard from Ms. Sundin the desire to have some rate restructuring or incentive restructuring. Not necessarily decoupling, but something along those lines.
Dr. R, I have a question for you. In this process, it seems that there's a lot done to engage stakeholders, utilities. Has there been much done to engage ratepayers, i.e. to reward those who voluntarily use less by maybe giving them a break on their monthly bills, or to find a way to structure it so that those consumers who are being the most efficient are being rewarded above and beyond the merits they're taking on their own behalf?
Mr. Chair, in the discussions that we had, certainly, as I said, with a wide-ranging group of stakeholders, to say that there were individual ratepayers involved, we didn't have a huge audience in that respect. We did have the representatives, however, of the general ratepayers there, the Attorney General's Office, the Office of Energy Security, were very much involved in those discussions, so ratepayers' interests were well represented. Under decoupling, rates are adjusted and set based on whatever the revenue requirement is, and they will fluctuate up or down depending upon what happens to the sales. The savings that go to customers who are aggressive about pursuing efficiency is presumably in the bill, in their monthly bill. If they are effective at actually saving energy, then their bills go down, even though their rates might, individual per unit rate might not. So that's sort of the trade-off involved in decoupling, and sometimes ratepayers have, you know, you have to slowly explain it because sometimes it's challenging to understand that, but that is part of the issue that we're dealing with.
It just seems that those people who want to really put forth the extra effort, they're being left out of the potential rewards of being proactive. I just was wondering if we could maybe expand the scope of what we're looking at to maybe find some incentives, because ultimately this is consumer-driven, and, I mean, at the end of it, so if we can engage them, I think these programs would be much more successful. That's my point.
Mr. Chair, if I may make one observation, at least on the natural gas side, one thing that I do think is important to remember is that on the customer bill, about 80 cents on the dollar is the cost of the natural gas supply itself. So when the customer is taking aggressive action to conserve, they're saving directly 80% of that bill. Where any adjustment might come through a decoupling mechanism is going to be the 20% of the rest of the bill. So any savings that they've gone out and sought will far outweigh any ultimate bill impact, at least for a natural gas utility.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Swanson, for that last comment. Because that gets at one of the puzzling parts of this whole discussion that I'm thinking about. While we're demanding that you sell less of your product, yet we allow you to protect your rate of return, wouldn't it be a natural conclusion then that the effect of this on the ratepayer will be that the cost for service for a given sales unit will naturally go up if we allow decoupling in this case? And then the follow-up is there a contrary experience in any of these other states that have already tried this? Or is this something, maybe, Dr. Haar, that's going to be weighed as we're coming forward? Because it looks to me at the end of the day that the individual ratepayer is going to pay a little more one way or the other for the privilege of saving some power here.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I understand the question right, and bring me back if I'm not hitting it, to a degree, the phenomenon you're talking about is already happening. Because to a degree, right now, as Representative Kalin said, CenterPoint, for example, has seen declining use per customer for the last 28 years. Since 1971, the average use per residential customer is about half of what it was back then. And those declining sales right now, because we do recover our fixed costs through per unit sales, as Ms. Fundine testified to earlier, as sales erode, right now the regulatory paradigm is we come in for another rate case to reset and recognize those lower sales volumes. So decoupling is one way to get out of CenterPoint filing every year or every other year, which people get tired of.
Well, Mr. Chair, just an observation that 27 years, I know you've been flying more and more homes in the Twin Cities, but sales per customer is actually going down. I would just remind the committee that predates any CIP program that we dreamed up. I think that probably happened just because customers get tired of paying big heating bills and did better windows, doors, and insulation, among other things.
Global warming.
Oh, the global warming, I forgot that too. So, anyhow, just thank you. But remember, at the end of the day, folks, it's the ratepayers that pay for everything we do here. And I just want to make sure that got on the record.
Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak on behalf of what we're talking about?
I just have a question. A question for research for Mr. Elis, if he's able to find it. When did we institute the Conservation Improvement Program?
The earliest reference in that section of the law is 1980.
Thank you.
Nobody from the audience wants to speak. All right. Any further announcements from the committee?
I have an announcement.
Meeting is adjourned.